Hello and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, today we're going to have a look at another view of the civil rights movement, as remembered by Drew H. Lackey. Now, Drew H. Lackey was actually a chief of police, and he served in the United States Marine Corps from 1942 to 1946. He served 25 months in the South Pacific. His police career began in March 1948. The police recruit school was held at Maxwell Air Force Base. The class started with 40 recruits, but only 33 graduated, as it was a very intense training program. Lackey attended the Institute of Applied Science in Chicago in 1951, which braced exhaustive studies in fingerprinting, firearms identification, modus operandi, and the identification of handwriting. He was awarded a diploma in scientific crime detection. In 1952, he was promoted to sergeant. In 1953, he attended the FBI National Academy at Washington, D.C. and Quantico, Virginia. In 1955, he was promoted to lieutenant and then to captain in 1960. Lackey attended Northwestern University at Evanston, Illinois from 61 to 62 and was awarded a diploma in police administration. He was promoted to assistant chief in 62 and was placed in charge of all the outside field forces. He was promoted to police chief in 67. A graduate of Jones Law School with an LLB degree in 68, Lackey retired from the Montgomery Police Department as chief of police in 1970. And at that time, he opened a private investigation agency, which he sold in 1973. Lackey began working for the Alabama State Board of Pharmacy as an investigator, retiring in 2003 after 30 years of service. Lackey married the former Patsy Ruth Johnston on March 21, 1947, and they have three sons and one daughter. Lackey is a member of Fraser Memorial Methodist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, where he has served as a lay minister. He has also served in the prison ministry, is in charge of coordinating the ushers, and has participated in numerous other activities in the church. A lifetime member of the Alabama Peace Officers Association and the Fraternal Order of Police, Lackey is also a member of the FBI National Academy and the Marine Corps League. And he dedicates this book to his loving wife, Pat, who stood by him and had to raise the four children almost by herself due to the long hours he worked. And he also says it is to all of the police officers and police reserve who worked long hours and endured verbal and physical abuse. You saved the city of Montgomery from riots, burnings, looting, violence, and deaths. All of you deserve the Medal of Honor. I am proud to have worked with such an outstanding group. You stood tall and handled your job with professionalism in protecting the lives and property of this city. This will be the only reward you will receive, knowing that you did your job and you did it well. To all the mayors and city commissioners who served during these tumultuous times, in your dedication and devotion to duty, you helped save our city from chaos. To all the people, both white and black, who helped us in keeping law and order during these difficult times, many thanks. He says, I am writing this book because people need to know the police officers' side of the civil rights movement. This movement was more than about civil rights. It was designed to intimidate and demoralize the police in this country and cause chaos in our cities and states. The civil rights movement actually began on December 1, 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on a City Lines bus to a white person. This began the bus boycott on December 5, 1955, and lasted for 381 days. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled the bus segregation laws of the state and cities were unconstitutional, thus ending the bus boycott. The civil rights movement spread throughout this county, causing riots, burning, looting, deaths, and chaos in many cities. The police took a lot of physical and verbal abuse from these protesters. They did their job in a professional manner and saved this country from chaos and the Communist Party from getting a foothold in this country. The movement was being partially financed by the Communist Party, and they had many people in key positions in the movement who were calling the shots. The police received this information through their intelligence units and the FBI. The police took a bum rap from some of the liberal media. If there was a large-scale confrontation between the police and the people breaking the law, the media usually reported in one of two ways. Either the police used excessive force, or they let the situation get out of hand. Any force used to prevent the situation from getting out of hand was called excessive force. If the police arrived in large enough numbers to squelch disorder without the need for force, then sending in so many officers was called overreacting. If an incident involved a white police officer and a black criminal, the media called it police brutality or racial profiling, and usually did not check out the facts. This book will reveal the many problems police officers faced in Montgomery and other parts of the county during the civil rights movement. There were many people fooled by Martin Luther King Jr. and his so-called non-violent movement. I want to tell the other side of the story about what happened in Montgomery, Alabama, during the civil disobedience demonstrations. The people involved in these demonstrations had no respect for the police or the city of Montgomery. They marched and took over our streets in violation of our laws. When police officers would stop them, they would shout obscenities and try to intimidate the officers. However, the officers stood tall and acted in a professional manner. We were putting in long hours to protect the lives and property of Montgomery. Montgomery was a powder keg, and the least little spark could have set off a bloodbath. The police were on the alert and prevented many incidents from taking place. When the civil rights demonstrations began, Commissioner L.B. Sullivan put me in charge of all the outside activities. I was assistant chief at the time. The chief of police was Marvin Stanley. I went to Birmingham to see how they were handling the marches and demonstrations. I witnessed the use of fire hoses and dogs to break up the marches. And when I saw this, I decided we did not want to use these tactics. I also went to Selma and observed how they were handling the situation. After observing these two cities, I mapped out a plan for us to follow. The plan was basically to use only the force necessary to protect the lives and property of the city. We would respect everyone and enforce our laws fairly and justly. I know all of this is easier said than done, but you must remember police officers are human. We tried to adhere to this plan, but I admit we all made mistakes at times. I'm proud of the part I played in it, and would like to commend all of the officers of the Montgomery Police Department and Police Reserves for their dedication and devotion to duty to make Montgomery a safer place to live. I feel the foundation of this great nation has been seriously challenged in a variety of ways, and had it not been for the dedicated and professional way in which these challenges have been met by law enforcement officers on all levels, there would have been a breakdown in law and order with far-reaching implications. The challenges facing law enforcement is growing larger due to terrorist activity and crimes of violence. It has become increasingly hazardous and difficult to serve the American public in the uniform of a law enforcement officer. We expect him to show the composure of the clergyman and the knowledge of an appellate judge, and if he fails, he is condemned or scorned in a manner never inflicted on any other public servant. Vigorous law enforcement is needed to cope with the crime and violence in this country. It cannot be achieved if the arresting officers are required to make an apologetic approach to every law violator, killer, rapist, robber, and thug roaming the street. If the rule of law is to prevail, the law must be enforced. We are asking our police to operate under an honor system in dealing with an element of our society that has no honor. Certainly, arresting officers cannot be permitted to resort to illegal tactics themselves, but they must be allowed to perform their duty with confidence and with assurance that they have the support of the public, the government at all levels, and the courts. If we do not support our law enforcement officers in doing their job, then the thugs will take over our streets. My view of the civil rights movement. Dr. Martin Luther King originated the twin ideas of non-violent protest and civil disobedience during the civil rights movement. Non-violence, as practiced by Dr. King, meant that civil rights advocates may break the law without moral blame. Dr. King stated that if a man believes a law unjust, or if he wishes to violate a just law in order to bring a condition of claimed social injustice to the attention of the public, he may break such laws. This philosophy was the root of all sit-ins, lie-ins, mass demonstrations, lootings, burnings, and all the other offences against the community that have been committed in the name of civil rights. In effect, Dr. King was endorsing breaking of any law, and this is an open invitation to law-breaking by anyone who chooses to do so. The late Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter once said, "If a man can be allowed to determine for himself what is law, then every man can. That means first chaos and then tyranny." Dr. King and those who followed his philosophy led the way to violence that took place in many cities throughout this country. We know that communists were in the civil rights movement. There were pamphlets, leaflets, and newspapers with the underlying theme. The true champions of the Negro people are the Communist Party and the Soviet Union. Their goal in the movement was to provoke bloody racial strife. H. Rapp Brown was freely quoted in the public press and on television in a speech, which was made from a Washington, D.C. Episcopal church. "We will make the Viet Cong look like Sunday school teachers. Violence is necessary. Get your guns and burn this town." He went on to say, "If America don't come around, we're going to burn America down, brother. We're going to burn it if we don't get our share of it." Stokely Carmichael and other adherents and advocates of the communists inspired the Black Power movement and visited Moscow, Hanoi, and other communist countries at will, and in violation of federal laws, were never arrested. Yet he continued to preach violence in this country. I ask you, when did rioting, burning, looting of stores, stealing of merchandise, sniping, and murder become a civil right? Martin Luther King was the most notorious advocate of civil disobedience in this country. He precipitated violence wherever he went, while falsely professing to oppose violence. He proclaimed by radio and television the night before he was shot that he would only obey those laws and court decrees of which he approved, and would contemptuously disregard and violate those of which he did not approve. Whenever police officers were sent to stop the violence the King's followers caused, King would scream police brutality. It was a simple two-step process. Number one, King would provoke riots by his comments. And number two, when the police came to stop the ensuing violence, his followers would resist and then blame the injuries on the police. King's methodology was very similar to what Fidel Castro used initially to take control of Cuba. In a memorandum circulated in Cuba before the Communist Revolution, the first point in the formula was to discredit the police in every way by causing incidents which lead to arrest and then charge police brutality. This is the same program that was being carried out by Martin Luther King Jr. in the United States. There is no doubt there were some unjust laws and injustices in this country, but the end does not always justify the means. Where would we be if everyone picked and chose only the laws they wanted to obey? I believe King's tactics and preachments during the civil rights movement in this country has been the main cause of the increase in crime and violence up to the present day. We are living in fear and barring our doors for fear of robbery, burglary, rape, assault, and death. This hue and cry of police brutality has handcuffed the police in doing their job. The thugs have taken over our streets, and the people had better wake up and give the police the power and authority to do their jobs. The police must be able to use that force which is reasonable and necessary to make an arrest. Give the streets back to the police, and they will stop a lot of the crime and violence. It is as simple as this. Let the police do their job. If not, the thugs will take over and control our streets. Let's take a look at some of the happenings in this country due to King's tactics. We start out with a presumptuous statement that a man can break a law he believes unjust, the doctrine of civil disobedience, and we end up with a riot in which 36 are dead, 895 injured, 4,270 arrested, of which 76% had previous criminal records, 209 buildings burned, and 787 buildings damaged, with 15,000 National Guardsmen and 5,000 police required to stop the riots. Thousands of guns were stolen from pawn shops, hardware stores, and sporting goods stores. The air was filled with "Kill Whitey" and "Burn, baby, burn." They started out with a so-called non-violent protest, and they ended up providing a haven for communists and the worst criminals of the Negro underworld, leading the citizenry into organized violence and mass destruction. Dr. King spoke of social injustice, but his tactics and his preachments led straight to the black Muslim pamphlet circulated in Los Angeles during the height of the riot, which stated simply, "Rise up and take what is rightfully yours." Perhaps the most vicious aspect of the challenge to law and order by mass crime arising out of the civil rights movement was a deliberate effort to destroy the morale of our police force. It had reached the point where any criminal, black or white, who was arrested screamed police brutality. The cry of police brutality is a deliberate effort to render law enforcement ineffective. The police feel that pressure groups have succeeded in preventing them from fully enforcing the law where minority individuals are concerned. Crime and violence defile human dignity. Dr. King and many of his followers tried to make us believe that no change for the better can come without violence, burning, looting, and illegal tumult of all kinds. Due to the turmoil inspired by King and his friends in the 66 Chicago riots, where King engaged in his civil rights war, Illinois Congressman Edward Derwinski described King and his cohorts as Dr. King's professional riot-inciting group. In the Chicago riot of July 66, Mayor Richard Daley said the strife was planned by King and his aides for no other reason than to bring discord to the streets of Chicago. King had spoken to gang members and showed them a film of the Watts riots just before the Chicago one. This riot was intense, with roving bands of youths and some adults who broke windows, stoned police cars, burned and looted. Two deaths occurred, 100 were injured, and there was extensive property damage. This went on for 3 nights. Dr. King never chastised looters, arsonists, or conspirators of violence. He always justified their actions and directly encouraged them. J.H. Jackson, an African-American who was president of the National Baptist Convention at Kansas City, Missouri, stated that King was causing problems all over America and that King's actions were responsible for designing tactics that led to a fatal riot and the death of Reverend A.O. Wright in Detroit. King often warned of impending riots if his demands were not met. King stated he was very pleased with certain victories and riots by the Black Power group. King told African Americans that they should not suppress rage, but vent it, so it would cripple the operations of an oppressive society. King practiced the big lie technique. Repeat non-violence over and over so the public will believe you, and then practice violence or the encouraging of violence. Remember, the communists are masters of deceit. J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, once called King the world's most notorious liar, and he never retracted his statement. On January the 5th, 1929, a boy by the name of Michael was born in Atlanta, Georgia. His father's name was also Michael King. His father was married to a woman by the name of Alberta. In 1934, after touring Bethlehem and Jerusalem at the expense of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, King's father proclaimed that he wanted to be called Martin Luther King and that his son, Michael, would be renamed Martin Luther King Jr. He did this because he admired the work of the Protestant reformer in Germany, Dr. Martin Luther, for whom the Lutheran Church was named. Martin Luther King Sr. and Jr. went by these names during the rest of their lives. There are no records at the courthouse to show that the names were actually legally changed. Martin Luther King Jr. became the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1955. The civil rights movement started in Montgomery on December 1st, 1955, when Rosa Parks was arrested for violating the bus segregation laws. The bus boycott began on December 5th, 1955 and lasted 381 days. The US Supreme Court ruled that the bus segregation laws were unconstitutional. On several occasions, King preached that African Americans should disobey any unjust laws, but who would decide what is a just or an unjust law? Martin Luther King Jr. apparently decided what laws should and should not be obeyed. Stokely Carmichael, a militant African American, voiced an ideology very similar to King's. He stated, "To hell with the law." King felt like he could decide what was legal and what was not. He felt the rules did not really matter, that he only had to obey what he chose to obey. You can see that such a course of action is fraught with danger, for if everyone took it upon himself to break any law that he believed was unjust, it is readily apparent there would be complete chaos in this nation. And this is what King set out to do, and unfortunately, very few in government positions recognize this. Law enforcement in this country faced many crisis situations due to King's tactics and handled them in a professional manner, but received no credit for saving this country from chaos. Roy Wilkins, the national director of the NAACP, said, "We need 100 skilled revolutionaries, dedicated men, ready to die. We must make each a platoon captain, and each must get 100 more. New York can be changed by 50,000 well-organized Negroes. They can determine what will happen in this city and country." Martin Luther King Jr. stated in July 1956, referring to the Negroes in this country, "These are people who will riot, burn, loot, commit violence, death, and chaos in this country. They have nothing to lose." This is but a small selection from the hundreds of public statements made by individuals prominently identified with the civil rights movement. Is it any wonder that the members of the black population who are criminals and revolutionaries feel the black leadership has given them a license to kill, burn, loot, and cause chaos in this country? This is excusing the crime in advance. This is providing an alibi for the criminal before he commits the crime. And this is placing in the hands of the criminal and revolutionary element the tools with which they can lead the young, the ignorant, and the irresponsible into joining them in an orgy of destruction. King portrayed US troops in Vietnam as foreign conquerors and oppressors, and he specifically compared the United States to Nazi Germany. He spoke of Ho Chi Minh, the communist dictator of North Vietnam, as a national leader and the innocent victim of American aggression. Congressman John M. Ashbrook, on the floor of the House of Representatives on October 14, 1967, stated, "King has consistently worked with communists and has helped give them respectability that they do not deserve, and I believe he has done more for the Communist Party than any other person of this decade." King has admitted that he had read the works of Karl Marx to try to understand the appeal of communism for many people. He scrutinized the Communist Manifesto and also read some interpretive works on the thinking of Marx and Lenin. A.J. Must abandoned his Christian pacifism and became an avowed Marxist-Leninist. Must served as close friend and mentor to Martin Luther King Jr. and his wife, Coretta. In February 57, Must was the head of a delegation of observers who were invited to attend the sessions of the 16th National Convention of the Communist Party. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover said, "The communists boasted of having impartial observers cover the convention. However, most of these so-called observers were hand-picked before the convention and were reportedly headed by A.J. Must, who had long fronted communists and who had recently circulated an amnesty petition calling for the release of communist leaders convicted under the Smith Act. Bayard Rustin was found guilty of violating the Selective Service Act and was sent to the federal penitentiary in Ashland, Kentucky for 3 years. In 1953, Rustin was arrested for public indecency in Pasadena, California. This was the first time that Rustin's homosexuality had come to public attention. In 1956, Rustin organized the Young Communist League while he was at City College in New York. He was very active in the communist movement in this country. Rustin also spent time with King in Montgomery and Birmingham, advising him on tactics. On August 28, 1963, Rustin was active in the march on Washington where Dr. King made his speech, "I Have a Dream." Something to think about. My mother always told me, you are judged by the company you keep. Stanley Levison, a Jewish communist, was one of King's behind-the-scenes handlers. Levison, who had for years been in charge of the secret funneling of Soviet funds to the Communist Party, USA, was King's mentor and the brains behind many of King's ploys. After King's death, his wife, Coretta Scott King, described Levison's role as, "always working in the background, his contribution has been indispensable." A number of communists who left the party have reported they were ordered to do all within their power to support King's activities. A black woman, Julia Brown, was a communist in Cleveland for 9 years. She said, "We were told to promote King, to unite Negroes and whites behind him, and to turn him into a sort of national hero. We were to look to King as the leader in this struggle," the communist said, "because he was on our side." While in the party, I learned that King attended a communist training school, that several of his aides were communists, and that he received funds from communists and took directions from them. He was one of their biggest heroes. The U.S. Congressional Record of March 30, 1965, quotes Carl Prussian, an FBI counter-spy inside the Communist Party, as swearing, "At all of these Communist Party meetings, Reverend Martin Luther King was always set forth as the individual to whom communists should rally around. King accepted support from communist fronts, individuals and organizations which espouse communist causes." We know that King attended the Highlander Folk School in Monteagle, Tennessee. This was a communist school funded by Miles Horton, the Communist Party organizer for Tennessee, and Don West, communist organizer for North Carolina. A meeting was held at this location with King, Horton, and West, along with Abner Berry and James Dornbrowski. All but King were acknowledged members of the Communist Party USA, and the agenda of the meeting was a plan to tour the southern states to initiate demonstrations and riots. Bayard Rustin, a draft dodger, homosexual, and communist, came to Montgomery in 1957 as an advisor to King. Rustin made a trip to Moscow in 1958, and after returning, organized the first of King's marches on Washington, D.C. In 1936, Rustin joined the Young Communist League at New York City College. Convicted of draft dodging, he went to prison for 2 years in 1944. On January 23, 1953, the Los Angeles Times reported his conviction and sentencing to jail for 60 days for lewd vagrancy and homosexual perversion. Rustin attended the 16th convention of the Communist Party USA in February 57. 1 month later, he and King founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or the SCLC. After Rustin organized the first march on Washington, D.C. for King, the official organ for the Communist Party, The Worker, openly declared the march to be a communist project. Rustin would help King organize the much later march on Washington, which took place on August 26th, 1964. And we will leave that there for today, and we will continue tomorrow with The Beast as Saint, the truth about Martin Luther King.